This is Bristol Bay and Beyond, KDLG's weekly news magazine. It's Friday, February 19th. I'm Dave Benninger. Thanks for joining us. Coming up this week, the Chief Justice of Alaska's Supreme Court, Craig Stowers, joins us to talk about the future of the state's courts in tough financial times.
To the extent that it's possible and cost-effective to have some state presence in rural areas, that's a desirable thing.
We'll get an update on how local communities are or are not getting policy set on commercial marijuana. Stakeholders are looking for a way to kill more Nooshigak Peninsula caribou, which would be good to see happen soon, say biologists.
If the caribou population continues to grow unchecked, the habitat will no longer support the caribou that are there, and they're likely to leave, and they're likely not to come back.
Winter showed up this week, and some youngsters shared their dusted-off recipes for snowmen.
Heart eyes, a pencil nose, and rocks for the buttons, and stick for a mouth, and thick arms, and a hat.
Plus, it's finally time to start talking about that other winter thing. Those stories and more are coming up after a look back at some of the week's news. On Sunday morning came news that longtime Representative Max Gruenberg, a Democrat from Anchorage, had passed away at the age of 72. Senator Bill Willikowski has represented the same neighborhoods as Gruenberg for the past 9 years and offered some reaction Monday morning.
Just shocked and saddened at his loss. He was a friend, a mentor to me. He was a statesman, and really sad to see him go.
There will be services this Sunday in Juneau and next Thursday in Anchorage. Governor Bill Walker will appoint a replacement to Gruenberg's seat after Anchorage Democrats submit a list of three candidates. The 1,000-mile Yukon Quest dog sled race was decided Monday, with Hugh Neff of Toke claiming the title for the second time. Neff pulled into Whitehorse around 2:30 Monday afternoon. KUAC's Molly Reddig reported from the trail and said that Neff had kept a low profile during the race until the halfway point at Dawson.
He kind of downplayed his team at that point. He was saying that he didn't have his eye on the win, and he was just happy to be, you know, close to the leaders. And from Dawson on, he's run a really aggressive race. He did a really long run out of Dawson, and when Moore and Sass were camping, he kind of shot straight through. And since then, he's just taken really brief rests and done longer runs than the competition. And so that's pushed his lead up to 2 hours by the time he got into Braeburn.
The 48-year-old had more than a 2.5-hour lead over defending champ Bryn Sass as he headed into the home stretch. Neff will take home about $35,000 of the $115,000 prize purse. Governor Bill Walker released an amended operating budget Tuesday, touting an estimated $135 million in additional savings from more cuts. But the governor did add $340,000 back into the budget to keep the Dillingham District Attorney's Office open, a move Representative Bryce Edgman said he was glad to see.
Well, you know, obviously I'm very pleased. And I think it's the outcome of a lot of hard work, both down here in Juneau and, you know, from a lot of concerned citizens in the, not just the Dillingham area, but also, the Bristol Bay area as a whole.
Edgman says it'll be among his top priorities to keep that funding there in the operating budget until it gets approved by the legislature. This week, Walker also announced that by executive order, he will transfer many of the functions of the Commercial Fisheries Entry Commission, or CFEC, to the Department of Fish and Game, a move that could save an estimated $1.3 million annually. While many have called for such a change, Edgman told us that the governor's action was unexpected.
Boy, you know, it sure took me by surprise. We've had legislation that works for at least a couple years on it. I was last night at a United Fishermen Association event and talked to a lot of fishermen and fisheries, people from around the state, and nobody knew about it. So it really just caught a lot of us off guard.
In other news from the state's capital, Walker's Natural Resources Commissioner Mark Myers announced he'll be retiring March 1st, citing personal reasons. That makes for the third change to Walker's cabinet in 3 weeks, following changes at Corrections and Education as well. This week, Senator Lisa Murkowski brought a handful of U.S. Senators and U.S. Energy Secretary Ernest Moniz to Bethel and nearby Oscarville. Murkowski used the field hearing of the Senate Energy Committee to highlight some of the challenges in rural Alaska, especially how the high cost of energy can cripple economic development. She also said there are solutions on the horizon.
The answer for a community like this, in a region like this, is how we can access the energy assets that are here. So what do we have? We've got the Kuskokwim River. We've got the wind. We have the sun. This is going to be the future of our small, remote communities. They will be their own microgrids.
The Nooshkak Peninsula Caribou Planning Committee met this week to consider special action requests to enable more harvest for the remainder of the spring hunt. Proposals include same-day airborne hunting, increased bag limits, extending the spring season an additional 2 weeks, and opening it up to all Alaska residents. The Federal Subsistence Board could make a determination on those proposals in the next couple of weeks. Fifth grader Ryan Burkowski won the Dillingham Elementary School spelling this year by a hair, or maybe a
smidge. S-M-I-D-G-E, smidge.
That's correct.
Burkowski edged out fourth grader Raina Tuckwood, who took second place, and he'll go to Anchorage for the state spelling bee next month. And this week, a tale of good old-fashioned Western Alaska gumption came to us from Scammon Bay. Two boys were missing Wednesday night on a trip back from Chivac. 74-year-old Francis Charlie headed off solo in bad weather in search of them, despite just having had bladder surgery a week prior. His wife, Teresa, told KDLG this morning she didn't think there was anything she could do to stop him.
There was nothing I could do because he kept wanting to go. He was so worried. The only thing I gave him was a bottle of holy water.
On account of the surgery, Francis Charlie tells us he had to stand up during his two-hour solo search and rescue. He did eventually find the two boys about 15 miles to the east and brought them back cold but unharmed. More on this week's news, including that story, can be found at our website, kdlg.org. You're listening to Bristol Bay and Beyond on KDLG. Craig Stowers was appointed to Alaska's Supreme Court by Governor Parnell in 2009 and was elected to serve a three-year term as the court's Chief Justice last July. Justice Stowers has worked in both public and private law positions in the state since the mid-80s and has been in Alaska since the mid-70s. Last week, Stowers delivered the annual State of the Judiciary address to the legislature in Juneau. He described the way the court system is balancing budget cuts this year and warned lawmakers that further cuts could begin to erode the way the courts serve Alaskans, perhaps especially in rural parts of the state. Stowers is in Dillingham for the official opening of the new courthouse and joined me earlier this morning. Your Honor, thank you for the time.
You're welcome.
Please be seated.
That's my
Sorry,
line.
I had to. How is the court system managing current budget cuts?
Well, we're doing all kinds of things, from the very smallest, which is just trying to save dollars here and there on things like travel, supplies, and whatnot. But given the magnitude of the budget cut, we have our three big strategies are to basically achieve savings from attrition when employees leave service. We keep those positions vacant, and that's probably our largest source of savings. Our employees are phenomenal, and they have agreed to voluntarily take leave without pay. From the clerk of court position to even many of our judges, and so we've achieved a very large volume of savings in that regard. And then we also have closed courts on a very limited and targeted basis, and that's our plan. Those three strategies for going forward as well.
Why are rural courts potentially in jeopardy of being closed with future cuts in your mind, or are they?
It's a possibility. We hope not. But the reality is, we have a very limited budget. We're a very small branch of government by way of comparison to the other branches and even many of the other agencies. We have a very large geographic distribution of where our courts are. A lot of these courts in the rural areas have relatively small filings. I mean, some of them 100, some of them maybe 200 or 300 case filings a year. If you compare that, say, to Anchorage, your average judicial officer in Anchorage has maybe 1,200, 1,300 case filings. And in most locations, it's not just the magistrate judge out in the rural area, but it would also be a support staff person to assist with calendaring and filing and data entry and mailings and all of those kinds of things. And so you end up with a situation where you're spending two full-time positions, say, on a court that really doesn't justify two full-time positions. We have some strategies where, you know, we may be able, say, as a magistrate judge retires or leaves service, to cover that court with another magistrate judge from another small area as well. And then I have some other strategies in mind, too, but I don't think you want to get that deep in the weeds.
At least not yet, anyway. You have mentioned that courts serve as a face of government, a very unique interaction point for the public and its government. Closing courts is not ideal, I don't think, in your mind, is it?
It's not ideal in my mind. It's not ideal from the court system's point of view. And frankly, I think you would get agreement from our brothers and sisters in the legislature and the governor's shop as well. You know, to the extent that it's possible and cost-effective to have some state presence, you know, in rural areas, you know, that's a desirable thing. You know, people have needs. For example, in the realm of our responsibility, if you have a domestic violence situation out in rural Alaska, as you know, there's few areas that have trooper presence there, and it takes a long time for troopers to get there. You have village safety protective officers in some villages, but not all villages, and they're not always there. But at least if you've got access to the courts, then you can start the process of getting a protective order, hopefully putting in place some protection until other authorities or resources get there.
Could tribal courts at some point be a partner with the state's legal system to handle some of these changes?
I think it's possible. This is me speaking, you know, very generally at this point. As you know, there has been a lot of discussion in this administration and past administrations, you know, about what is the proper, you know, role of tribes and their jurisdictional status. And of course, that's an issue that principally, you know, would come from the legislature, you know, with the governor's input. There are mechanisms that we've already put in place so that when tribal courts issue essentially, you know, protective orders from that court, you know, we can register them. We've got new rules in place so that those orders would be treated just like any other state's protective order. So we're making big steps in that regard.
In your speech the other day, and this is something that we've seen quite a bit of, I think, lately, is an increased use of things like video conferencing and even just telephonic hearings to save travel costs when defendants are far-flung from the court that they are being arraigned or tried in. Do you believe that those defendants who are arraigned or tried or whatever is the hearing is over the phone or video conference are getting the same quality interaction with the justice system as somebody who gets to look at the courtroom, see their accusers, the attorneys, and the judge face-to-face, eye-to-eye?
I think that they are. I think it's important to understand that there are different levels of proceedings that occur in a courtroom, and some of them on the relatively low end of consequence are status hearings, trial scheduling hearings, things like that. And I think for those kinds of, for lack of a better word, lower-end hearings, I think video conferencing is the way to go. At the other end of the spectrum, when you have trials, sentencings, and things like that, absolutely the defendant has a right and should be present in order to face accusers, to face witnesses, and in order to exercise the full panoply of due process.
In your State of the Judiciary last week, you challenged our elected lawmakers with what I thought was some pretty lofty rhetoric, even citing Churchill and such. Sitting atop a co-equal branch of government, I would ask your opinion. Do you think that your colleagues in the legislature are up to the task of these times?
All right. So first, I'm a lawyer. Object to the word rhetoric, although I get it in the classical sense. Maybe that's appropriate. You know, Plato might agree with you. What I tried to do with the members of the legislature was basically to encourage them. You know, the legislature is in a very difficult situation, as everybody knows, with our budget situation and the decreasing revenues. And they have lots of ideas about how to respond to this, and that is their constitutional task. They catch a lot of criticism, and I understand that. You know, people have a right, and indeed we're Alaskans, and so it's our sacred duty, you know, to criticize government in some ways. But I wanted the legislature to hear a positive message that, you know, they are uniquely situated to address these challenging problems that they faced, much as the delegates to our Constitutional Convention were facing a very challenging situation. The delegates to the Constitutional Convention proved it's possible to bring people from a wide variety of political views and views about what government is or should be. And they succeeded in creating a constitution, our state constitution, which is just an astonishing work of statesmanship. And this legislature can do that. And I believe they can do that. I believe that they want to do that. I don't think any of them want to leave this session, you know, not having made major progress. And I'm believing in them.
Do you enjoy your job on the Supreme Court, even before you were Chief Justice?
Very much so. I enjoy the law. I enjoy history. I enjoy working with people. When I was a trial court judge, I enjoyed working with people, real people, having real problems in real time. Now I'm on the appellate court, and I don't get the opportunity to work with the people so much, but still the problems that people bring to courts to have us solve for them and to make a contribution to the state is just a very humbling thing, and I'm honored to do that.
Chief Justice Craig Stowers, thank you so much.
Thank you for your time today. You're welcome.
And we'll have more from that interview, including Stowers' thoughts on soon-to-retire Justice Dana Fabe and the late Antonin Scalia, posted at our website. This is Bristol Bay and Beyond, back in a moment. Last Friday marked the 24th anniversary of the death of Dillingham police officer Anthony Jones, who was killed in the line of duty in a downtown shootout. That incident left an indelible mark for all who were there then, and last fall we revisited Tony Jones' death in a two-part series with his former fellow officer Terry Rogers. Rogers, who was also shot at, spoke about that night, about Tony, and about his own efforts to reconnect with the shooter Eugene Maude. When we aired those conversations with Rogers, quite a few people reached out to share some of their own memories and thoughts afterwards. One of those was Marilyn Rosine.
I knew Tony and Trudy Jones. My husband worked with the police department, and so Tony was a familiar face for me and was an important person in our daughter's life as well as a preschooler. And that whole time when we lost Tony was one of those events where if you were here, you would not forget it. And I think the memory that we have of Tony is as a vibrant young man who was serving his new community of Dillingham as law enforcement and reached out to lots of young people. And I think that's what's doubly sad about this situation.
Among the many clippings, photos, and articles Rosine saved was a poem that Tony Jones' widow Trudy wrote 5.5 years after Tony was killed. At that time, she asked Marilyn to share it with the Dillingham Police Department. We spoke with Trudy this week and asked if she didn't mind if Marilyn could read that poem here. She told us that'd be just fine.
It's strange how the pain comes rushing like the wind. When I let those memories in of that night, my dreams did end. Those words that they said rang in my head. I'm sorry. Your husband is dead. I went to different places, searching all the faces, hoping he'd be there. After all the time I spent and places that I went, he wasn't there or anywhere. That's finally when I knew just what those words had meant. It caused me such great sorrow. For me, there was no tomorrow. In the days and months that followed, my heart grew dark and hollow. So, one shovel at a time, I tried putting it behind, only to find all my feelings, thoughts, and emotions were buried in my mind. Thanks to friends and family, they showed me what life meant to me. The loving things they did and said helped me want to move ahead. I must have been blind. It was there all the time. Each and every day, the sun would start to shine. Now 5 years have come and gone, and I've been living, moving on. I'm happy with my life this way, and been asked to be his wife someday. I'm loving life and him a lot, and can't wait until we tie the knot. The pain is no longer from that very night. I've grown so much stronger. I've fought with all my might. I look for each tomorrow with him at my side, feeling no more sorrow. Instead, the warm sunlight. By Trudy Jones, September 12, 1997.
This is Bristol Bay and Beyond on KDLG. Very soon, marijuana commercial grows and retail shops will be legal in the state, at least in those parts of the state that choose to allow them. Communities are tasked with figuring out their local preferences about that. Many have already done so, some choosing to ban commercial pot from their areas altogether, others gearing up to cash in on Alaska's newest green industry. Molly Dishner writes for the Bristol Bay Times and for KDLG and has been checking around this week to see what our communities have or in many cases have not done along those lines. Molly, good morning.
Good morning, Dave.
What's next? When will the state start accepting applications, and when could commercial marijuana businesses potentially get going?
The state starts accepting applications on Wednesday. The earliest they could process any of those, they're saying, is March 16th, and businesses will still be a ways out. They're not really going to even be looking at all of the licenses right away.
It seems like there's going to be a problem of how businesses in rural Alaska get their products mandatorily tested because they can't put them on air flights.
Right, and that's still the holdup. There is no workaround right now, so people can apply for a license, but it's pretty unclear how they'll make that happen. I talked to one person in Dillingham who thought maybe there was room for private airplanes to leave from a private location, land in a private location, maybe get around it, could still be subject to some federal laws there.
Before we get to any of that, though, it's up to the communities to decide if they want to have commercial businesses, whether that's growing marijuana or selling marijuana. You've been checking in all across Bristol Bay this week. What's the temperature? What do you think we'll see?
A lot of waiting and seeing to see exactly how the state regulations play out if this testing issue actually gets resolved. I think one important thing is that people can apply for those licenses regardless of what a community does. So if a community doesn't take action, people can go ahead with their business plans for now.
Has anybody definitely said they are not going to allow?
Yes, Togiak is a definite no. They've already voted on it. Manicotic and Nustu are both planning to ban commercial businesses. New Haven's going to talk about it, a little less certain on their position. The Bristol Bay Borough is looking at a moratorium for a year to give them some time to develop their own regulations.
Anybody possibly a yes?
It sounds like Bristol Bay Borough could be just developing some more regulations. Dillingham also looking at what regulations it wants to implement through the Marijuana Advisory Committee.
Okay, that committee, you've spoken to some of the committee members who are sort of the council's feelers for the rest of the community. What's the Marijuana Advisory Committee telling you so far?
So far, it sounds like they're just interested in getting together and figuring out what's going to work for Dillingham. There are six possible business types. Maybe we'll have all of them, but maybe we'll only have some. And then how they write those regulations in a business-friendly way.
When is the first time that a marijuana business in Alaska will legally be able to retail pot? Soon?
This summer. I think June is what we're hearing, although they would have to get it grown pretty quickly to make that happen.
All right, so plenty more details left to sort out in this marijuana mess.
Yes.
Molly Dishner, thanks so much.
Thanks, Dave.
Wow, how much better Bristol Bay looks in the winter with a little fresh snow on the ground covering up our ample blemishes. It's been great to see snow go tracks to and from town and folks getting out at lunch for a quick ski. KDLG's Hannah Colton headed out to see what a few folks were up to on a sunny Thursday in a Dillingham all gussied up with a few inches of fresh powder.
Can you introduce yourself?
Robert. They know who I am. Robert Galvin, yeah. And that's Satara Lynn Galvin. I'm Satara.
Satara, and I'm 9.
Can you tell me what you're doing right now?
Shoveling.
We have to get the snow machine going. My sister's doing it right now.
What is she doing?
She's fixing the snow machine.
We're just getting the snow machines ready to go for a quick ride before the snow goes again. So, yeah, probably just up to Khalifa to take them out sledding and stuff and let them ride the snow machine before we wake up next week and we have no more snow. So,
My name's Carlos Corolla, and I'm from Massachusetts. Just moved there a few months ago, and actually on break at work. The snowfall is awesome. Definitely something new for me. I mean, I haven't really experienced much snowfall from where I'm from, so, I mean, riding a snow machine around for transportation is awesome.
My name is Harmony Larson. I made a snowman.
Can you tell me what all it has on it?
Heart eyes, and a pencil nose, and rocks for the buttons, and stick for a mouth, and thick arms, and three snowballs stacked on, and a hat on it.
What's your name?
My name is Alora Wassily.
How did you feel when you saw that there was snow outside?
To make a snow puppy.
So a snowman is like one, two, three all on top of each other. How do you make a snow puppy then?
One big snowball and four circles on the bottom and a skinny tail and a little round head and ears.
This week, stakeholders gathered to discuss some ways to harvest more caribou from the Nooshigak Peninsula herd. Now in the third mostly snowless winter, the herd is growing beyond what the habitat can likely support. For more on what that might mean for those caribou, and to talk about what at least one of the proposed solutions to see them more of them killed soon might be, I'm joined by Pat Walsh, the lead biologist from the Togiak National Wildlife Refuge. Pat, glad to have you in the studio.
Glad to be here.
Can you remind us briefly the history of the Nooshigak Peninsula herd? Were there caribou there before they were reintroduced?
There were caribou present more than 100 years ago, and there are records that indicate that that was the case. But there was a long absence of caribou on the Nooshigak Peninsula until they were reintroduced in 1988.
And how many were brought into to start the project?
146.
And they've done well?
They've done very well.
What are we up to today?
There's about 1,400 caribou down there now, as best we can count.
And you and Andy Aderman and others have determined what to be about the right size for that area.
We have a population goal of 400 to 900 with an optimum size of 750.
So you want to see about half of this herd harvested in the near future?
Yes, we do.
Why is that important?
Well, the herd's important as a subsistence resource to the communities around it, Manakotik, Dillingham, Alaknagik, Togiak, and other communities. If the caribou population continues to grow unchecked, habitat damage will occur, and the habitat will no longer support the caribou that are there, and they're likely to leave, and they're likely not to come back if the habitat is damaged beyond the point of being able to find food.
What in your mind keeps the caribou on the Nooshigak Peninsula? What do they like so much about that spot?
Well, we don't really know. And when the herd was initially established, people thought that it's unlikely that they're going to remain there as a non-migratory caribou herd, but perhaps they'd use the peninsula as a calving area, move off to feed, return there to calve. But in fact, they have demonstrated pretty much a non-migratory behavior, which is not completely unique, but it's unusual with caribou. And whether they will continue that forever is not at all certain. In fact, it's likely that they eventually will leave, but it's far more likely that they'll leave if they deplete all the habitat that's there and don't have a reason to stay. So as long as the habitat conditions are good, we may be able to maintain a caribou herd there.
Now, it's a tricky spot to get to for hunters both seasons, but it's much more accessible in the wintertime, provided there are good winter traveling conditions. And I think most of your harvest comes from the winter months, correct? On a good year?
That's correct.
This is now three winters in a row that the hunting has just not been really possible, frankly. And the herd is growing. What can we do? What's being proposed, and what in your mind might actually work here?
We've tried a number of strategies to increase harvest. We've recognized for several years that we need to increase it. We've increased the number of permits we've issued to virtually an unlimited number, but it doesn't matter how many permits we issue if people can't get down there.
Right.
And we're in the process of working with other, removing other restrictions, increasing the bag limits, extending the season length. There's a proposal to permit same-day airborne. But none of those are likely to cause the real increase in harvest that we're looking at. And so right now the hunt is restricted to seven villages in the immediate vicinity of the peninsula. We are proposing to open the season or open the area to all state residents. And the rationale for that is that there are state residents who would come here in the fall by aircraft when people in Dillingham and Manicotic traditionally do not go down there and potentially harvest large numbers of caribou. This is a controversial issue. People are fearful of bringing in outsiders to harvest a resource that's been available to them and not available to someone else. But the thing that people should try to think through is where's the greater fear? Is it the fear of outsiders coming in, or is it a fear of losing the resource altogether? And that's what could happen. So what we're looking at is to use this outside harvest potential only during times of overpopulation, but write it into the rules whereby when the population falls under the population goal, that only the local federally qualified users have access to it.
So there's some flexibility there.
Yeah, there's flexibility. We want to design rules that will work locally to correct this problem. And failure to do this could result in losing the resource completely.
You said that could happen. Do you think that's likely to happen, and within how long a time?
It seems very likely that it'll happen, and it seems likely that this will happen within a few years, not within a decade. It's not going to happen this year, I don't think, but I don't think we have much time. We have to act now to be able to get ahead of this.
All right. Pat Walsh, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
And finally, before we go, in the land of fox and muskrat, the sockeye and the king, there's a pioneer tradition remembered every spring.
It's taking a vacation when the trapper's work is done and rounding up the efforts of a long, hard winter's run. Beaver Roundup.
Well, the fun gets underway next week, and coordinator Charlene Lopez joins me now for a quick preview with the understanding that the full schedule will be online tomorrow. Charlene, good to see you.
Good seeing you too.
Can you give us a few of the highlights for this year?
Yes. This year we have a few new things. An exciting thing is the Youth Dillingham Leadership Group, known as YDLG, is doing a community spirit week every day of Beaver Roundup. Wednesday is a pretty packed day, being the first day of Beaver Roundup. Of course, we'll go into our parade, costume fun run. We'll have the outhouse race, followed by the pushcart derby. And then Dilly Capers this year is going to be a little bit different, and I'm pretty excited about it. We're going to do Dilly Capers featuring live music by Ken Pilter. Opening for Ken and his band will be the Baby Walk in the traditional fashion show. So
that's all Wednesday?
All Wednesday.
Okay, so you got to mark the calendar for Wednesday. There's just too much to do. You can't miss.
Yes.
Okay, well, briefly, what's Thursday, Friday, and the weekend look like before we follow up with you next week for more specifics?
Okay, Thursday, the biggest event that I want to highlight today is the third annual Traditional Foods Feast Potluck, and we're adding this year the largest Eskimo bingo game ever.
A challenge to Bristol Bay. They told us they had it.
Yes.
All right.
We are challenging ACMIC.
We'll have to verify.
Yes. So Friday, we'll start off with our Cinnabon breakfast. A new event, as everybody is familiar with, in the summer, we do the color run with BBAHC.
Right.
This year, we are doing for the middle school and high school. On Friday night, we'll do a color dance for the middle school. We're bringing in a DJ from Anchorage. Should be fun, throwing powder on the kids every 15 minutes. And then following that, the adults will go out to the Willow Tree and have an adult crazy color dance party. So that's Friday night. Saturday starts off with our Arts and Crafts Bazaar, Tug of War, Family Olympics. And then Saturday night, we are bringing the Polynesian Paradise Dancers back for a luau. But this year, we're making it bigger and better.
Now, a guy like me, I never miss the Polynesian Dancers.
It was an amazing show last year. And it's going to even be better this year. And another event that will run from Monday through Friday next week that is new is Traditional Chopped. So everybody will register to do Chopped all week, and then we'll have the championship on Friday.
So we don't have the snow, which means we don't, again, have the dog sled races or the snow machine races or a lot of that, but there's still lots of good stuff to come out for next week.
Yes. I believe the whole week will be packed. I still think that everybody's going to have a great week.
So we'll follow up with you next week and get some more information on our news and announcements. And I definitely want to thank you and the rest of the crew that helped you put this together. Such a big, important, fun time for everybody, snow or no snow. Thanks so much, Charlene.
Thank you, Dave.
So come on, friends and neighbors, please listen to this song. This is an invitation. We'd like you to come along. We've had 40 years of Roundup, and we'd like at least 40 more of good time celebration on the New Shagak shores. Beaver Roundup by the shore.
Well, that's it for this week's Bristol Bay and Beyond. Find this and past episodes at kdlg.org. I'm Dave Benninger. Keep in touch. Enjoy that snow this weekend, and we'll see you back here again next week.
And celebrate the Roundup time in Dillingham, a.k.a. Beaver Roundup. By the shores of the New Shagak, Beaver Roundup. When the trappers all come back, Beaver Roundup. Where we gather in the old familiar way. And celebrate the Roundup time in Dillingham, a.k.a. Thank you very much.